You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm Radio for Open Ears. This is the latest installment of my show. It's a monthly show called Reading is Funkdamental. We talk about books, about music, jazz, rock, whatever. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. I play in a band called Spaghetti Easter Music and Space Heater and a couple of others. And I also write about music for Pop Matters, New York Times occasionally, Rolling Stone, Inside Out, Upstate New York. We are here today talking about a great book written by Walter Koloski. He is sort of the foremost John McLaughlinologist. John McLaughlin, the great jazz fusion and every kind of style guitar player. This is his newest one. It's called Mahavishnu Memories. It is a critique of the original band's gigs from 71 to 73. I saw the band twice, the best live band ever. Absolutely. So without any further ado, let's get on with the show and talk to Walter about John McLaughlin and the fantastic Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Okay, here we are. We're here with Walter Koloski, who is the world's greatest John McLaughlinologist, I guess. he has written three books about the man, the great man, the most fantastic man, in my opinion, as a guitar player, a composer, spiritualist too. You know, the guy had it all. Walter, actually, I read his first book that I read and that I believe he wrote about John was A Passion, Power, and Beauty, which was a history of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He followed that with a book called Follow Your Heart, which was more of a biography to a certain point in his career, I believe. And then the newest one is called, it's fantastic. It's called Mahavishnu Memories, and it is really a concert-by-concert chronicle of the great first edition of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. I had the pleasure of seeing, as we were discussing before this, several of the shows that he mentions in this book, and I guess I saw some good ones. Not that there were any bad ones, but let's welcome Walter here. Well, thanks for joining us on Reading is Funkdamental.
Hi, Sal. Great to be with you.
Great. So before we get into this, just give me a little background on you before you started writing about John. You were a journalist first and kind of how you got into music and all that kind of good stuff.
Well, of course, I saw Mahavishnu on TV before I became a journalist, but that's what I went to school for. I ended up becoming a broadcaster, a radio broadcaster, and a newspaper reporter until I realized I couldn't make any money doing that.
Yeah.
So I went into a regular business. And then years later, when the internet came out, I found a John McLaughlin website that came out of Estonia. If you can imagine that.
Like one of those GeoCities sites?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the guy was doing a good job, and I was reading about John McLaughlin. It was a John McLaughlin site called Pages of Fire. This is in the early 90s. And I sent him a note because it was pretty weird sending a note to somebody from Russia in 1992 because they had just opened up. A far cry from what's going on now, but that's another matter. And I sent a note to this guy and I said, hey, I know John McLaughlin's music and I'd be happy to supply you with some reviews of his records. I know all the records and I'll send you some short reviews if you're interested. And he said, of course. So I, at that time, there were maybe 30 or so albums.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, from memory, I reviewed each one and sent them to this guy. Andres was his name, Andres Dietrich. And some people saw these reviews and I started writing some more stuff. And before you knew it, I started being paid for stuff I was writing on the internet. And one thing led to another. And I started writing books. Of course, I'm of the belief that you write what you know about. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to call myself a John McLaughlin jazz fusion Mahavishnu historian.
Right.
That's really what I look at when I think about what I've been doing and what I try to do. And I approach writing about John, and in this case, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, much the same way as when I was a newspaper reporter, mm-hmm. which would be, in this case, in Mahavishnu Memories, I treat each concert as its own story.
Right. Yes, and in this book, it's really amazingly detailed. It's like you dug into the archives of the various colleges because, you know, they were very big on the college circuit. That was a huge thing at that time. You know, you would dig into that. You obviously musicians like Janis Chambers, musicians who I think you said Gary Husbands too was in there, musicians who saw them before they became the musicians that they became and the influence on them. So it's actually a really fascinating, and it was a very fiery band, about the most fiery band there ever was, the most fearsome live band there ever was. As we get into this, we will talk about the many people who they just kind of blew away on stage, and you know, headliners like ELO, who said, you know, Jerry Garcia, who said, I don't want to play with these guys anymore, and people like Zappa, who basically, what I understand is Zappa completely re-engineered his band after he saw Mahavishu, and to some degree his guitar playing too. So that was that's really fantastic. But let's just give a little background before we get into the Mahavishnu Orchestra, which is at the heart of this. A little bit about John, you know, his upbringing. You know, his mother was a classical violinist. He sort of had an absent father. He started on piano and violin. And his musical, how did his love of music develop?
When he was about 12 years old or so, he got a guitar from one of his older brothers. And he would listen to flamenco music and the blues on radio, and he became interested. Of course, he was interested in classical music too because of his mother. And they played a lot of music at home. As you said, the father wasn't around, so the mother was the major influence on him. But he fell in love with the guitar. I think he said he fell in love with the D chord. You know, it's just the first chord he really
It's the happiest chord there is, actually.
fell in love with that. And he became so enamored that he would practice so long and so hard that his fingers would bleed. And his mother would say, hey, you know, take it easy. But even through his 50s and 60s, he was practicing hours and hours a day. You know,
Right.
you how to become good with the facility on any instrument, that's the number one key. But of course, when it comes to McLaughlin, things are a little different. We can talk about that later. I mean, it's the music combined with the style that creates something unique out of John. And of course, what I would call his vision, which is unlike anyone else's vision. And all great musicians and great artists, of course, have their own singular vision, which some people call stubbornness. I call it a vision. I mean, that's really what it is.
Well, there's nothing, it's a very distinct musical genre he really created, and that not I can't really think of anybody who's sort of followed in his footsteps in terms of the complete immersion in, you know, like you say, electric jazz fusion. You know, there's Django in there, but you know, there's a lot of Indian music too.
Well, to me, it all comes down to his what we'd call attack on instrument, his attack, his approach. And I remember a famous quote, at least famous to me. There was an interview back in the 70s someplace of the great John Scofield, famous jazz guitarist, electric jazz guitarist. And the interviewer said, why do you never record acoustic guitar? And John's answer was, have you ever heard John McLaughlin play acoustic guitar? And that was his whole reason not to play, because it would be compared to that, and who could compare it to that? I once described John's playing as sticking out like a jagged rock on a cliff. Something about it that was so different. And of course, this is just one element. At any rate, to get back to the history, John became what he called a studio shark in London because he could play anything. So he'd be playing blues, rock, jazz, you name it, he was on it. And he was on some recordings with, say, Engelbert Humperdinck, you know, Petula Clark, you know, some soundtracks of movies that you would be familiar with. He did a lot of recording with Burt Bacharach. And in fact, there's a video on YouTube now. If you pay close attention, there was a television special in England, I'm going to say 65, 66. And John's in the band playing guitar. And there he is. I was lucky enough to see that on YouTube and send it to John. And he said, "Oh my God," you know, because you see a very young John McLaughlin.
Yeah.
Playing guitar with Burt Bacharach.
Well, one of my favorite cameos of his is in the movie Round Midnight. He's in the band. And it's the music is so gorgeous in that particular I think he plays As Time Goes By with Dexter Gordon. Herbie's in the band. I'm not sure. Was it Alphonse Mouzon who was the drummer, I think? I think it was Alphonse without the dreads who was the drummer in that
movie. I don't remember. But I remember scene, you know, the two scenes, and in one of them, John looks into the camera. He's quite charismatic, and I could see him sort of being a movie star if he wasn't a musician.
So, you know, from there, you actually said during his something I learned in your book was that during his studio days, he actually gave lessons to Jimmy Page.
Yes. And Jimmy mentions this from time to time. The other interesting person that I won't say he taught him, but gave him some pointers, was Pete Townshend.
Oh,
because,
wow.
Yeah, because John McLaughlin used to work in a guitar shop.
Right.
And these guys would come in, and, you know, that's where he met him. And again, in one of Peter's books, he mentions that he was given great help on his chord structure by seeing John McLaughlin. I think the name of the store was the Selmer store, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes about that. Dennis Chambers tells a cool story about Jimmy Page, who was recording in the 90s in London someplace. And it turns out that John was recording at the same place in another studio in the same building. And when Jimmy found this out, he freaked out. He told Dennis, "That guy is my teacher, he's my teacher," you know, this type of stuff. And, you know, he went and surprised John. Sometimes you'd be surprised of the people that admire the Mahavishnu Vishnu Orchestra. It's not just jazz players.
Oh, no. I mean, it's a very special energy. And then before we get into the Mahavishnu, in that period too, and before he got to the U.S., Graham Bond played a big role in both his musical career, and then you reference in one of your books, you know, his interest in Eastern philosophy was emerged from his time with...
Right, John was always open to that type of stuff. Graham Bond was sort of rhythm and blues, and of course also playing with John at that time. Was Ginger Baker, you know, was playing in that band, and Jack Bruce.
Right.
So, you know, it was a very fertile period. But Graham Bond was interested in the occult. He was quite an interesting character.
Yes.
He was interested in the occult, and John started researching, you know, different religions and whatnot at this time, or at least spiritual movements. And John was a drug user at this time,
right?
And had continued for a bit of a time. And at a certain point, he decided he wanted to get away from that. Mm-hmm. And especially when he came to America, he did what others did at that time, which Michael Shreve describes as guru shopping,
right?
Which is something that he did, and he's in the book, Michael is. And he found a guru in Sri Chinmoy and, you know, practiced what I consider, you know, their own form of Zen, you know, in some way. And this affected his life. He claims it didn't really affect the music, which is
interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. And he said Sri Chinmoy affected his life, but had zero effect on his music.
Hmm. And he used to always do a lot of concerts, like free concerts in like Central Park. I remember that. I think I was telling you this, that my first apartment when I moved out after college was near Parsons Boulevard in Jamaica, Queens. And it was two blocks from Shree's whole compound and grocery store. And so I would see them. I actually saw John walking around
once.
Yeah, John ended up owning that restaurant, the Follow Your Heart restaurant there in Jamaica, Queens.
So let's talk about, leading into the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He makes the jump to New York, and that's to he came to New York to play with Tony Williams. And how did that all come about? And how did he go from Tony to Miles?
Well, Tony heard a tape that Jack DeJohnette made of a jam session he had with John in London. I think Dave Holland was involved as well. And Tony was looking to put together a new band that was going to sort of, for lack of a better word now, fuse jazz and rock music. He wanted to do something different. Of course, he was a young phenom, still young at this point, of course, a young phenom who played with Miles Davis. But he wanted to do something more electric. And when he heard this tape, he invited John to come to America to be in his band called the Tony Williams Lifetime with Larry Young. They played music that was about, oh, I don't know, 1,000 years ahead of its time, played at tremendous volume, which drew the fascination of a lot of players like Herbie Hancock and Miles and others. Unfortunately, because of the nature of the music, the volume, and terrible management, the band failed commercially.
One of
But
the wor one of the worst ever recorded albums. I mean, sonically, it was a
right.
sonic disaster.
Yes and no. Because later on, because of that disaster, there was a lot of punk rock character to it. And so, the Ramones and some people like that, I know, I can't remember which Ramone, probably Joey took an interest in it. In fact, ended up working on another McLaughlin album behind the scenes for Alan Douglas. But there was sort of a charm to that amateurish sound. For some. Now, John isn't a stranger to being disappointed with the recordings of some of his albums. Devotion is another one he was really sort of angry about.
Well, that was kind of the, that was really the, I really like it now. I didn't like, I got it after, meeting after the Intermountain Flame, and it was a little. But the more I listen to that album, the more I like it. It's just, but it was over the top. It was the post-production, I guess, that really.
Yeah, the songs, the producer put songs in the different orders that they were supposed to be and stuff like that. Now, of course, I've always loved the album. But if you listen to Lifetime and Devotion, 1970, you hear the birth of Mahavishnu
Definitely.
because you hear definite themes in there and approaches. Sometimes, even in an album like Extrapolation, which was even before he recorded that in London, you hear tunes where John would change the tempo later or fool around with, and they would become seminal masterpieces.
Well, and there's another great album. One of my favorites is the one he made with Larry Coryell, Spaces. Is when was that? When did that one come about?
69, 70, about the same time, and there's a couple of nice pieces on there. Renee's Theme, which is an acoustic with
Beautiful.
Larry and John, which is really, really nice. It's funny, Larry always said that his favorite John McLaughlin album was that, when he appeared on his own, on his record. But yeah, I don't know, there's not a lot of Mahavishnu in that, but there's Billy Cobham on there and Chick Corea and John
There's
and
Love. There's Love Edith, I think.
yeah, there's a lot of
The other
stuff.
one, the other interesting one, he did have an element, he did experiment a bit with free jazz with Gunta Hampel. And actually, I live in West Saugerties, right next to Woodstock, and I used to, he just recently passed away, Carl Berger, who he was, did the, that's a great album, When Fortune Smiles. Is that a
That's really free jazz, and
Oh.
I think I write about that someplace. I know I did, but that's one of those albums that I take out once a year, because the free jazz,
Yeah, I
a
know.
little difficult, but again, there are hints of Mahavishnu in there, And you'd hear this later, and it's interesting exercise, at least for somebody that follows the music like me, to see what he did to change this theme a little bit or whatever. But and of course, those hooks, they appear as hooks in free jazz. And those attract me. This is the first time that he ever played that hook, and then it became something later. You had mentioned Follow Your Heart earlier. That book really wasn't a bio. What it was I
Song by
looked
song.
at song by song, you know. So, and I got his input in many cases, and just where did this song come from? What were you doing? And it was just really to focus on his composing, which he always dismisses, which I always find humorous because as we sit here, it's being played someplace in the world by a symphony orchestra or a big band ja or big
He did
jazz
like the concerto, the Mediterranean concerto. He did some
band.
ballet scores. He did a lot of stuff that any a very distinct composer. So just briefly through his through Tony, through that, he gets to Miles Davis. He's on some of the seminal albums there. And Miles Davis is the one who basically says it's time for you to do your own thing.
Yeah, John was gigging with him, which he occasionally did. He wasn't part of the ongoing band, but in fact, he was in Boston. I'm here in Natick, just outside Boston. He was in Boston, and John was a little restless, and Miles said, "Hey, it's time to form your own band. I mean, that's really what it's time, you know, to help you with this restlessness. That's what it's all about." And that was the beginning of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He ended up naming it that because it would take people out, the orchestra part especially. But the Mahavishnu, which again is sort of loosely translated from the Hindi, is creator and preserver. And this is the name that his guru had given him, and he decided to name the band that. What was interesting to me about the formation of the band, and in Power, Passion, and Beauty, I go into great detail about this. He was really playing with two people. One person he knew, which was Rick Laird, the bass player. He knew him
London.
from, and he was getting to know Billy Cobham because he was, met him around the time they were doing the date with Miles. And of course, appears on the great album Tribute to Jack Johnson, which is really the major killer record that most people should pay attention to if they're into jazz fusion. But the other people, Jerry Goodman and Jan Hammer, he didn't even know. And so they ended up forming a band with two people he didn't even know, which I think is an unusual thing.
Did you say that Jerry was not the original choice? Did I read that in your book or?
Yeah, it's well known that his original choice had been Jean-Luc Ponty. But there were issues getting Jean-Luc to the United States and whatnot that, created a stumbling block. And he heard an album from The Flock with Jerry Goodman, and there is a solo violin piece in there. And when he heard it, he said, "That's the guy I want in my band."
And you say in the Mahavishnu Memories book that in the initial some of the initial things is that Jerry was probably the best known musician to sort of
Yes.
the rock world because he was, you know, the Flock was one of those bands like Jay Giles that, you know, was always on the bill somewhere that not the headliner, but on the bill working backstage.
Even in Europe, but especially here, maybe in New England, during all the colleges up and down the Ivy League schools and whatnot. And I would call, sort of the Flock. I would compare him to maybe Blood, Sweat, and Tears, in a way. They were heading in the same direction. But still, and there was another group, Dreams, which of course Billy Cobham was in.
Record
And
brother.
Larry Coryell was doing stuff, and even Chick Corea was doing some stuff, but nobody had found the magic key until Mahavishnu found it. The magic key was producing great improvised, loud electric jazz music that somehow found commercial appeal. That was the key.
Yeah, and he really came in the you know, there was sort of a lack there with the death of Hendrix. You know, the guitar god was gone. And at least to me, and you know, we were all around 13, 14 at that time playing guitar, getting started. We were like, oh, you think that's good? Listen to this. And that I was just very curious about the making of the first album and obviously the touring of the first iteration of this band. But like, how soon after he sort of coalesced this band did they go in the studio and did they get out on the road?
Right away. I mean, that it was happening during their first gigs at the Gaslight in New York. They were recording then and there, the first album. And of course, making the sound engineer quit because he couldn't handle the volume of the band. He quit. They had to get another guy in there that could deal with that. And they recorded the album very quickly. In fact, in some of those in the earliest days at the Gaslight, of course, there were different versions of what we hear on the record. You know, they're figuring things out, and that's what's always fascinated to me. And as part of this book, of course, I did a lot of intense listening to live. I'm just totally focusing on live recordings in this book. What was it like when the Mahavishnu Orchestra came to your town and blew your mind, which is basically, you know, the unwritten subtitle of this book, if it were. And it's fascinating to hear some of the early recordings, and some of the tunes are a higher, faster tempo, slower tempo, excuse me, tempo. Some are more urgent, some are less urgent. There's all these things going on. But when you listen to 200 or so shows, you can listen to Birds of Fire, the song, the tune, and find something different in every one, which is the brilliance of jazz. And in this case, you know, combining it with the rock and the Indian, as you mentioned before, and even a certain amount of grandeur, you know, a classical approach to some of the tunes.
Oh, sorry, forgot what I was going to say. I'm just curious as to the show. I briefly mentioned the shows that I was at, but were there specific shows that you're drawn to that you wrote about? There were about how many shows? The book, or the new book, deals with them. Their touring began in 71 and went through the end of 73, December 73. So how many shows was that? And this book is really focused on the original iteration of the band, which is the best iteration of the band.
You can only be new once, is the way. And to be fair, the other bands were great too, but this book took me 5 years to write. You can imagine if I did, and it's over 500 pages. So I had to draw a line someplace, and that's where I drew it. So there's about approximately, including sets and whatnot, 250, 275 shows that I write about in here.
And they were lucky to actually be featured, get some television coverage too. So you talk about some of the great things that you can actually see, shows that you could see online. So if you want to kind of talk a little bit about that, some of the great.
Yeah, sure. Now, to be honest, there was no television coverage until they started hitting it big. Now, there was some in Europe in 72, but in the US, it wasn't until 73, and the band was only going to last through the end of that year. The biggest show here was In Concert, which was in March of 1973. And I've told the story many times, I'll give a shortened version of it, but I saw him on that show, which was late at night and simulcast in stereo on WBCN, which was the big station here in Boston. Always not quite matching the video, but close enough. And of course, the technology, can you imagine listening to the radio and hearing stereo, which you couldn't hear on the TV at that time? They came on about 20 minutes to 1 in the morning. And I had a little 12-inch black and white TV set that was on the floor for some reason. And I'm looking at it, I go, who the heck are these people? You know, because they're very visually startling. But then they started playing, And I didn't get it. I go, what is going on here? There's a couple things going on here that you normally don't hear. Now, later, of course, I would learn what was going on, but at the time. I always used to try to describe how I was attracted to the band at that time. Back then in the 70s, there was talk about syncing a strobe light to your brain waves. This was a thing because a lot of places were using strobe lights. And what would happen if they could sync it to your actual brain waves? Like my hand will disappear, like right now, right?
Right.
It's amazing. What was it like? There's a name for that, which escapes my mind right now, because they actually do make an effort to do that. They have found it does affect your brain. But an easier description of the way it attracted me is to think of the old Star Trek TV series and the Enterprise's tractor beam. You know, it just pulled me in, you know, over this course of 12 or 15 minutes. And I was a rock fan at that time, you know, Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, 10 years after, I was a rock fan. But I couldn't sleep that night cell. I literally could not sleep because I couldn't wait to go to Mammoth Mart, which was the big department store where we lived at that time.
Right.
And I ran to the record section and I picked up Birds of Fire, which was their second album.
Right.
I didn't even know they had a first album.
Yeah.
And, I took it home and I listened to it probably five times in the single day and said, I got to find out more. Yeah. And that led me to Miles Davis and John Coltrane and all the history of jazz and everything that came before it. And within a couple of months or so, I literally gave away all my regular rock records because this was the type of music I was going to get into. Now, right. Later on, I realized my folly because there's a lot of great rock records that I had. And when CDs came out, I replaced as many as I could. Because you cannot live on jazz fusion alone. And so I did that. But from the first time I heard, 73, and of course all the earlier McLaughlin albums, just sort of like you, it was in hindsight that I heard them.
Right.
And there were hints of what was to come, and I picked up those albums that you talked about later on.
I don't know if your whole progress, this to me is the progress of people of, I'm assuming we're around the same generation, is that you go from rock and then you kind of go into, jazz rock. You make the jump from the Beatles to prog rock. And then prog rock, there's complexity, and then that gets you into sort of jazz rock. And then what I did is I went from jazz rock and then got more into 40s and bebop and all that stuff. So that to me seems to be the trajectory. The one thing about this band though is they, they're really the I would say the jazz band, the jazz rock band that really did connect with rock people. I have one recollection of my own. I went to see Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters at, I believe it was Stony Brook University. And guess who the opening band was? Miles Davis.
Yeah.
Miles Davis played Rated X. That was his whole set. Because he was not too happy that he was opening for Herbie. And and also that they weren't really into what he was doing. So it was like a half an hour set, as aggressive as it could be with that organ. But again, like like you said in the book, you detail very well the bands that they toured with a lot. They did a bunch of performances with ELO. They did a tour with ELO. They did a bunch of work with Zappa's band.
No ELO. I think you're thinking Emerson, Lake and Palmer. You're trying.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I wrote down ELO. I'm thinking of ELP. Right. Correct. Thank you.
Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Right.
That's an old brain there. But right. If you want to tell us a little bit about the various reactions of the, because some people like Santana, who we'll get into a little bit later, it completely, and Mike Sharif, it completely changed their approach to music. They were completely enamored. And then there were a bunch of people who were just like, I'll never be on the stage.
Well, the same happened in Yes. John Anderson and Steve Howe, they were huge Mahavishnu fans. And, They did a couple shows with them. Even imagine the Kinks, Yes, and Mahavishnu. You could find such bills back then.
Great.
But basically, they would watch, speaking specifically of Steve Howe and John Anderson, they would watch Mahavishnu perform and say, "We got to get our act together.
Right.
We got to be better." And that happened with a few other bands. Aerosmith is one. We said, "We need to be better." Blue Oyster Cult is another one. I used to call them the poor man's Black Sabbath. All these people are in the book. In these early days, the band would steal a lot of shows as opening act, and John has always said that was not their intention, but it was the result, and it had to be the result because people had never heard anything like this type of music before. And sometimes it would scare people, and they would literally run out of the theater. So Jan Hammer told me they used to love that. Because they'd say, "Oh, they can't take it," and they'd run out of the theater. There's a story in the book of a concert at the Beacon Theater, I believe, and Rick Laird, some of his friends from Australia were over, the Australian Jazz Quintet, and they were very well known there, but they were what they were. They were the Jazz Quintet, and he got them front row seats for Mahavishnu, and they were sitting down front. And they didn't know what to expect. So when Mahavishnu hit the first chord of Meeting of the Spirits, Rick said they left as if they were one organism, and they ran out of the building. They just couldn't take the power from the very first chord. And that happened to a lot of people. Now, other people, if I were in the crowd, would be transfixed. And of course, that was on a bill with Oscar Peterson. Can't imagine anything like that occurring these days, but that was the reaction, and within several months they were no longer the opening act, and they were playing to jazz to rock fans.
Well, what do you think? What role do you think the management played in them being successful versus, let's say, the Tony Williams band? Because, Tony Williams is as talented a drummer as Billy, for sure. Maybe more so in some people's eyes. And, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? So why did this band succeed where that band didn't succeed?
Well, that management was very important to Mahavishnu. Nat Weiss, who was the legal representative of the Beatles in the United States. So they played a great role in the ascension of the band and the descension of the band. Nat Weiss knew a lot of people. He knew Miles Davis. He knew Clive Davis. And that, so Mahavishnu had a great start. Actually, in the guise of John McLaughlin first, because John McLaughlin recorded for Columbia before the Mahavishnu pieces, before the Mahavishnu Orchestra. They got the attention of Clive Davis because Clive Davis admired Miles Davis, and Miles said, "This is the man." And they signed him to a contract before Clive Davis even heard a note of music of John McLaughlin's. So that helped. And it's a little vague at the beginning of the gigs. We don't know if how they got the first gigs at the Gaslight, opening up for John Lee Hooker. But the business theory that Nat Weiss used, he got from Brian Epstein, who was his close friend, and he was in business with him, which was play the band as often as possible. Get them out every gig you can get. Go and play it, every possible one. And then you'll reach a crescendo and some amount of fame. Well, in principle, this was a good idea, in theory. But Mahavishnu Orchestra was not the Beatles. The Beatles were great and better musicians than people give them credit for.
Yeah, definitely.
But they were playing half-hour and 40-minute sets.
yeah
Mahavishnu was leaving blood on the floor for an hour and a half, 2 hours every night. Night after night after night.
And it was a competitive, it's like athletic music. It was a very competitive band, I would think.
And it became more so. And that caused some problems. I mean, them breaking apart, exploding at the end was the only thing that was ever going to happen.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of, I was going to wait a little on that, but if you want to get into how that transpired with the interview and all that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, basically, you have to imagine there are no breaks. You know, most bands would tour for a month, a couple of months, take 4 or 5 months off, record an album, come back and tour. Mavishnu didn't do that. They just continually toured. And so they became tired and frustrated and exhausted in every possible way. And remember, as I always point out, that two of these people, they didn't even know each other at the beginning. The
Right.
only way they knew each other was on stage. And for the most part, they were always professional on stage. Only at the end, when Jan and Jerry expressed their disappointment to Crawdaddy Magazine, they weren't getting enough credit. That's a whole nother basket. Did things fall apart in Japan for a few shows?
Right.
It was just, the article was read on the airplane on the way over there. But you can imagine, Elliot Sears, the road manager, said the way he always looked at it was Mahavishnu was on one long continuous tour.
Right.
They might have a week off sometimes, they might have 2 weeks off, but for 2.5 years, they didn't take a break. And so this affected the compositions because they were written in many cases and worked out in sound checks.
Right.
They didn't have rehearsals, you know, well, the rehearsals were the sound checks at shows. And then they would go into the studio, and when they went to record their third album, the
Right.
tensions were so great that, you know, led to the fracture in the band.
So
But as I
that project did ultimately fall apart, but was ultimately released. That was the Triton session.
was replaced with a live
Right,
recording.
which I think I was telling you before when I was writing the piece for Pop Matters that I actually was at one of those shows in Central Park. And in addition to a show at Colden Auditorium at Queens College, which you said was one of the best ones. I mean, that was the first time I saw them live.
And get this, and you didn't know it at the time, that was the very first show that they did after they decided to break up.
Wow.
So imagine that. You know, they come back to New York after Japan, and they just decided the best thing to do was play the concerts out the rest of the year, cancel concerts for the next year, and probably not book December so much because December was light that year. But as I said earlier, as a general rule, on stage, everything was okay. But of course, toward the end, what you were talking about, you know, Rick Laird's 3 minute bass solo would be 10 minutes. John's 5 minute guitar solo would be 15 minutes. You know, they stretched as much out of this music as they could.
Right.
Those of us in the audience, I mean, we didn't realize what was going on behind the scenes. So there was no reason to doubt anything we were hearing. It's just the evolution of the band as opposed to the breaking apart of the band, which is what it really was. One of the things that I really, and I hope you found this when you read the book, is that Mahavishnu Memories is a very personal book. So
Oh.
I have the memories of people that were at the shows, the people that worked the shows, and in many cases, how these shows affected them the rest of their lives. If I had known you ahead of time, I would have spoken to you and got your takes on those shows. Especially at Queens College, because that would have been an interesting one
Well,
to
that was an interesting place because we were young and we would always, what would happen is there were side doors to the auditorium and somebody would open the side door and then we didn't pay and we would all rush in and we would dive into the aisles. So I think the first part of the set, I was like laying on my belly in an aisle, not saying
Right.
anything, with the piss and beer on the floor or whatever. But that was a great. The other great show that I saw, which was this is just jumping ahead a little bit, is I saw Shakti open for Weather Report
Yes.
at the Beacon Theater, and that was like just as electrifying as as the Mahavishnu Orchestra to me.
As acoustic as it was.
Acoustic, unbelievable. But
And stealing shows again.
So when did the so were I know Jerry and Jan did a solo did a duo album, and John made the famous album with Carlos Santana. So when did that transpire during this period of the first band, or when did that?
Yes, in August and September, with some weeks of delay and through various months, Love, Devotion, Surrender was recorded by Carlos and John. And Billy recorded Spectrum during the lifetime of Mahavishnu. Now, one thing I learned from the research in the book that album, Like Children, which was Jerry Goodman, Jan Hammer, which came out later. I had always thought that they had decided to get together after Mahavishnu broke up, but I learned that they had planned to do this album while in Mahavishnu, but it just didn't happen then. At least they planned it. I don't know if they planned to record it, but they had planned it long before they recorded it. One of the great revelations in writing a book of this nature, you had mentioned going to the archives and all that type of stuff. So sometimes I'd go back and find my own material that I had written 20 years ago. I'd read something as, boy, this guy's a good, great writer. Who wrote this? I go, oh, yeah, okay.
There you go.
just kidding. But sometimes I would find things I didn't know about at all by really digging. And of course, when you're a musician, life is in the here and now. The fans sometimes have a better memory, of course, because their memory is restricted to the shows they saw, a few shows. If you try to talk to members of a band from about music they played 50 years ago,
Get it.
you can't trust it.
Yeah.
Which is why I approach my writing. In this book's a little different because I allow people to have their memories. Sometimes those memories are not right. Like somebody said, oh, I remember the moment of silence. And I said, well, they didn't start doing the moment of silence until this time. And so you're confusing it with another time you saw the band. I don't point that out, but that's the case. And of course, you could even talk to John and he'll talk about something he did in 1971, and it was really 1973. But you it's easily understood. You do thousands of shows and intense, and again, you're in the here and now. And I consider myself, I just want to get the truth out there as best I can. When it but memories, are the truth to those individual people.
So what are just for people who are listening who maybe don't know this Mahavishnu, and especially let's focus on this particular iteration of the band. What are some of your favorite pieces or things that you would suggest someone listen to sort of learn about John's music, and what are the sort of this particular year?
Oh, just Mahavishnu music.
Well, let's start with Mahavishnu, and then I actually wanted to talk a little bit about what happened after Mahavishnu fast, and then you could tell me there.
Well, with Mahavishnu, I've always had a favorite tune, and that is One Word. That appears on Birds of Fire album. I think that's my favorite because every musician has time on that. You get to hear that Rick Laird, whose job in that was to keep the band centered, as opposed to being like a Stanley Clarke or Jaco. He always considered his job to, keep the band in the middle of sort of, a carousel, that middle pole. And he and Billy Cobham, being the rhythm section. And the thing is that these other guys were going off on flights, and if somebody didn't know the one, where the one was, or keep things steady, it was going to dissipate into space, into the ether, unless somebody held that down. Now, later on, Sal, you realize when he did was allowed to do his own solos that you go, boy, this guy is pretty creative bass player, especially if you get to hear any music in Japan. Toward the end when things were going poorly. And he'd say, "That's Rick Laird? My God." He had no idea. I mean, he'd carry the band for 7 minutes himself. He'd carry the band with his solo.
He was a very experienced guy in London, right? He was the house bass player at Ronnie Scott's, I believe,
Yeah,
or you know, or the other guy.
he played with all the great jazz legends. Pat Metheny got in touch with me because he was curating some recordings for the guitar player who all of a sudden his name escaped me. He was like, "Oh, for Wes Montgomery, for Wes Montgomery." And he was stunned that Rick Laird played with him on, and I said, "Yeah." And he says, "I want to talk to Rick Laird. How do I get in touch with him?" And I put him in touch. And so he talks to Rick Laird about what it was playing, what it was like playing with Wes Montgomery. And of course, another time, another place. I mean, Pat Metheny is directly descendant from Wes Montgomery when you really listen. One word would be my favorite. My next favorite would be Celestial Terrestrial Commuters. Something about that tune that I really, and that was an early tune called Binky's Beam off of Extrapolation. And he sped it up, I don't know, 1,100 times or 10 times, 100 times, whatever it was. And then all of a sudden, it became this other tune. But when the band was initially playing it, they used to call it Binkies, just because that's what John had called it way back in the day.
Well, we're going to wrap up here. I have about a couple more minutes, so we're going to take it past the Mahavishnu era. So let's just talk about some of the latter day. I know he had some, believe he had some physical issues with his hand for a while there, but he's back playing, correct?
Yeah, he's 83 years old, back playing like a house on fire. He's not touring anymore. He'll do some one-offs.
He did the Jeff Beck tribute, I think, or something on
He'll do
that.
some one-offs and killed it, by the way.
Yeah, nice.
And he'll do some one-offs. And there's a local jazz club in Monaco, which is where he lives, and he'll play there from time to time.
And I read he's a pescatarian somewhere. I don't know if you said that.
He's not quite a vegetarian. I've had the pleasure of dining with him numerous times. But even then, I think he was vegetarian when I dined with him, but I know he'll eat some fish.
So let's there's so much more to his career. This is certainly a high point, but there's so many more high points. But I just want to conclude by having you tell us where people. I know, do you still doing the Jazz Rocks podcast?
We're on a 3-year hiatus.
Okay, but it may
So
come back.
it may come back from time to time, but people that want to listen to that, a lot of the recordings are on the archives.org. I'm sorry, it's archive.org. So there's about, I think, 15 or 20 shows there. We interviewed everybody to do with jazz rock.
And where can people find out about your great work here?
Well, I do have a website. It's walterkoloski.com. It's mostly at this point dedicated to John McLaughlin and the Mahavishnu in particular in the book. There's a forum there. There's an interactive site there. There's the best gig list ever of the Mahavishnu
Oh my
Orchestra.
God, yes.
And there's rare recordings and videos there as well. You can learn where to buy my books. I have quite a few books out. Of course, Amazon, people go to, but also available, just starting to populate the new book at many other sites, and vendors will have the book. And if there are special requests, because sometimes those happen, you can contact me at my website.
Great. Well, all the best. Thank you so much for being on Reading is Funkdemental, and we look forward to whatever you get into next.
I appreciate it. Really enjoyed the conversation,
You
Sal.
too, buddy.